Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez ends his latest Middle East tour in Qatar at a crucial time for the wider region. The Gulf state has hosted several talks on ending Israel's war on Gaza. Prime Minister Sanchez's calls for a ceasefire and for Israel to respect international law have resonated worldwide. While he strongly condemned the October the 7th attack, Sanchez has also demanded the protection of civilians caught up in Israel's war on Gaza. As the death toll now stands at around 33,000, Spain's voice is growing louder in the international arena, demanding access to humanitarian aid and advocating for a recognized Palestinian state. Spain's foreign policy extends beyond the Middle East. It balances relations with major powers like the United States and Russia while navigating the broader implications of the war in Ukraine. Prime Minister Sanchez is at the crossroads of these complex geopolitical dynamics. How will Spain manage this era of global challenges and a rapidly changing international landscape? The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, talks to Al Jazeera. Pedro Sanchez, Spanish Prime Minister, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera. You were one of the first leaders in the world to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. I looked it up. It was the 21st of October last year. At the time you spoke, 4,651 Palestinians had been killed. Now so many others are calling for a ceasefire. The US has dropped its objection at the UN Security Council. We got a UN Security Council resolution. Yet the death toll now stands around 33,000. That means that more than 28,000 people, many of them women and children, have died since you first made your call for a ceasefire. Does that anger you?
I have to tell you, well, first of all, thank you very much for this interview. And I have to share with you that sometimes I feel very frustrated because, of course, we've been very vocal since the beginning of this war. We condemned these horrible and terrible terrorist attacks perpetrated by Hamas. We condemn those attacks, but, of course, we ask for a permanent ceasefire since 2-3 weeks after these terrorist attacks. And the reason is that you cannot answer these kind of attacks only with weapons or with the logic of war. There's other ways to deal with these terrible situations. And that is why, you know, I think it's really important to have the engagement of the old international community in order to ask for a ceasefire, to allow the humanitarian aid to access into Gaza, and of course, the immediate and urgent release of hostages.
Of course, there is no ceasefire in place. The guns went silent for a little bit at the end of November, just for 7 days. When the Security Council finally passed its resolution, all its members welcomed it. Even the US that abstained said positive things. It was welcomed by the Palestinian Authority. It was even welcomed by Hamas. The only people who didn't welcome that Security Council resolution, in fact, vehemently condemned it, were Israel. Is Israel an obstacle to peace at this stage?
I think that Netanyahu and his government, with this strategy, is getting more and more isolated internationally. In the beginning, I think that we all feel that solidarity with citizens and a society that was attacked by a terrorist organization. But afterwards, this unbalanced and horrible situation that appealed all the international community is putting Prime Minister Netanyahu in a very difficult and isolated situation within the international community. I can see, for instance, also in Europe, in the beginning of the war, some countries more aligned with the position, the political position of Israel, that nowadays have changed and shift their position dramatically, because their own societies are asking for a more tough and clear political positions towards what we are unfortunately witnessing in Gaza. In Spain, I can say that the majority of our citizens, they do believe that we need peace. We need to restore peace. We need to have an urgent and permanent ceasefire on the ground, and of course to answer the most urgent issue nowadays in Gaza, which is how can we allow the entry of humanitarian aid with the proportionality to respond to this humanitarian crisis that we are, or the Gazettes are suffering.
You're on a visit to the region. You've been to Jordan, you've been to Saudi Arabia, and you're now in Qatar. And here in Doha, along with Cairo, this is one of the places that they've been trying to get a deal on a ceasefire in talks. What's the latest you're hearing about that? Do you believe it's close?
I don't have information if it's close or not. What I can share with you is my will, and I think the will of the majority of the international community, which is to have this permanent ceasefire. And I have to also to remember that the resolutions of the Security Council are binding for all member states, also for Israel. So I think it's mandatory for the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, of course, to have this permanent ceasefire. And I think this will be a very important step in order to give a political horizon to the region, in order to open a peace process that could end the international recognition, the mutual recognition for the Israelis and for the Palestine people.
You talk about binding Security Council resolutions. There's not just the one on the ceasefire. At the end of last year, there were two resolutions that more aid should go in. Yep. The International Court of Justice, which also has binding measures it's announced twice, says the same thing should happen, more aid should go in. And yet it's not happening. Do you think Israel is in breach of the Security Council resolutions, the International Court of Justice measures? And if so, what action should be taken?
I think that there's actually some doubts in the sense that you are saying. And I can tell you that within the European Union, for instance, two governments, the Irish government and also the Spanish government, we ask the European Commission to make an assessment on the humanitarian rules, articles that are included in the a strategic relation that the European Union has with Israel.
That's the agreement that was signed between the EU and Israel. And if they find that Israel's not living up to its respect for human rights, for example, that is in that agreement, what action should be taken?
Well, in the case of the European Union, the situation will be that there's an open door to have a debate within the European Council in order to see if we continue with this strategic relation or not. But this is something that first we need to have the assessment of the European Commission. But anyhow, as I said before, the important thing is that nowadays, since the beginning of the war, more and more countries, especially in the Western world, are more reluctant to support and back what Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government is doing in Gaza. And there's an urgency to stop this terrible war and to open a new phase of stability, peace, prosperity in the region. And I think that for Europe, for instance, this is not only a moral conviction, which is the case, it's also in our geopolitical interest. It's in our geopolitical interest to have a stable and prosperous and peaceful Middle East. So this is something that I've been advocating, and that is why we've been very vocal also within the European Union in order to have this approach and also to have a strategic vision on what to do from the European Union with our southern neighbourhood, which, by the way, I can tell you, I think that there's plenty of opportunities for the European Union and also for these countries in the Middle East and the Mediterranean.
Humanitarians have repeatedly come under attack in Gaza, and the latest tragic incident, 7 workers from the World Central Kitchen, that's the NGO set up by the Spanish chef José Andrés, were killed. Yeah. They'd also been working together with a Spanish NGO, which had brought their food supplies in by ship. They'd come by ship because Israel's not allowing enough stuff in by land. How is any of this acceptable?
It is not acceptable. I think that it's important to condemn this terrible situation and the very dangerous, extremely dangerous circumstances that aid workers are working having on the ground in Gaza. And that is why I think it's important, first of all, as I did, to condemn this horrible bombing that causes the death of 7 workers, which, by the way, were working in Gaza because people in Gaza are starving and they need food. And this NGO, led by this Spanish chef, Jose Andres, what they do is just to provide food for the people. And of course, what we ask the Israeli government is to clarify the situation and why this happened in Gaza.
Of course, this isn't a one-off. More humanitarian workers have died in Gaza than anywhere else in the world. 150 or more UN staff members, more medical staff than anywhere else in the world. This begs the question, is the Israeli army just very, very bad at targeting? Or is it about their rules of engagement? Is there some sort of indiscriminate shoot-to-kill policy going on here?
I don't know. This is something that the Israeli government has to answer. What I can tell you is that the situation on the ground is not acceptable. And this brings me again to the same answer that I gave you since the beginning of the interview. We need a permanent ceasefire. We need to convene a peace conference, which, by the way, is something, a proposal that not only the European Union, but also the Arab League and the Islamic Conference, we agreed on. So I think it's important that from Europe and also from the Arab countries, we work together in this peace conference in order to move forward and to leave behind this terrible war and to establish the conditions for a peaceful coexistence in the short term.
You say Israel needs to answer these questions.
Yes,
does Israel potentially need to answer these questions to the International Criminal Court? Does there need to be accountability for these sort of actions?
There has to be always accountability. I think that the history is full of examples where it's urgent and needed this kind of accountability. But this is something that the International Court of Justice has to respond. And what we need to do is to ask the Israeli government to fulfill, which is nowadays binding, which is, of course, the UN resolutions calling for a permanent ceasefire.
We've talked about humanitarian workers, medical staff, journalists as well. More journalists have died in Gaza than anywhere else in the world. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu's government is banning Al Jazeera's operations in Israel. Is this quite literally a case of Israel shooting the messenger?
Yeah, well, I mean, the free press is on the hallmark of any, I would say, self-respecting democratic government. And from my side and from the Spanish side, what we do is to support the work made by journalists across the world, and especially in Gaza, in these very difficult circumstances.
You've talked about the famine in Gaza, which now the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Report, which came out a couple of weeks ago, says is coming, the full onset between now and May. It is a man-made famine, is it not? Would you not agree it's quite specifically an Israeli-made famine?
What I do believe is, and I was in Rafah at that time. You mentioned in the beginning of the interview, it is critical that Israel opens the possibility to have this humanitarian aid going into Gaza as soon as possible, and perhaps we're talking about, of course, land crossings, and of course in the amount of 1,000 or 2,000 trucks per day. This is the terrible situation that the people in Gaza are suffering, and this is something that the international community cannot accept. And that is why I think that not only from the UN Security Council, also from the European Union Council, we had a council some weeks ago, we commend the Israeli government to open these land crosses in order to have available this humanitarian aid for the Gazatees.
With regard to the EU, Joseph Borrell is the High Representative for Foreign Affairs. He used to be your foreign minister. You know him well. He said recently, if you believe too many people are being killed, maybe you should provide less arms in order to prevent so many people being killed. Does the EU need to stop selling weapons to Israel? And are you sure your country is no longer selling any weapons?
We're no longer selling weapons. And I do agree with this statement made by Joseph Borrell. And what I can tell you is that I don't think that this strategy is going to give more security to the Israeli society after this war ends. Because I think that the only way to have a peaceful coexistence and the security that the Israeli people needs is through politics and through diplomacy, and not with war and this especially terrible war that we're witnessing in Gaza.
So many leaders, including yourself, have been warning...
Not only in Gaza, also in the West Bank. Where
well,
we are
and maybe witnessing... beyond. And yep. That's what I wanted to ask you about, because so many leaders, including yourself, have warned about the danger
Absolutely.
Of this war spreading. In that context, Israel's recent attack on an Iranian diplomatic building in the Syrian capital, Damascus, do you think killed top officials of the Quds Force? Do you think that was acceptable or a reckless act of provocation
it's
by Israel?
It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. It needs to be clarified by Israeli government. And, of course, this goes in the direction that you mentioned before, which is we need to avoid an escalation of the conflict in the region. From Spain, we have deployed many years ago one of our largest UN missions on the ground, which is in Lebanon. Mm. And of course, we are trying to guarantee the peaceful coexistence between the Lebanese people and the Israeli people in that very difficult border between these two countries. And we are very concerned about the situation, and that is why we ask and we commend the Israeli government to try to avoid this regional escalation that we are witnessing, for instance, with this attack in Syria.
When the war is eventually over, who should run Gaza and who should pay to rebuild it? Should Israel be required, for example, to pay reparations for some of the damage they've caused?
In my opinion, the Palestine Authority is our partner for the international community. And I think that they have the capacity. And if they don't have the capacity, we need to give them that capacity to get the full responsibility of over Gaza, East Jerusalem, and also the West Bank. And from the Spanish perspective, I think that we are living now a momentum where the international community as a whole, we must recognize the full membership of Palestine in the UN system. And of course, bilaterally, from the case of Spain, we are ready to support and recognize the state of Palestine, because this momentum has to be different to the others that we witnessed over the past 7 decades, which is, OK, if we convene this international peace conference, the Palestine must come to the table with a recognition taken by the international community of their own state. And the debates with the international community and with the Israeli government, in my view, should be what would be the borders, what would be, let's say, the government, and so on and so forth.
You talk about the Palestinian Authority.
Yep.
Prime Minister Netanyahu says the Palestinian Authority can't run Gaza afterwards. How is the international community going to strong-arm the Israelis on issues like this?
If you have the Prime Minister in Israel, such as, you know, Netanyahu, who has been trying to weaken the Palestine Authority over the past years, this is the consequence that we are now witnessing in Gaza. What we need is to reinvigorate the Palestine Authority. I think it's important, and we are ready to work along with our friend, the President Abbas, and, of course, the new Prime Minister of the Palestine Authority. But I think that, you know, they have to take that full responsibility of Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And of course, again, the international community must take a very important step in order to recognize the state of Palestine. And by the way, also, I think there's a momentum for a mutual recognition. Also, some Arab countries have to recognize Israel too in order to have this peaceful coexistence.
The problem is, Prime Minister Netanyahu, you talk about two-state solution and whatever.
Yep.
He doesn't believe in that either.
Well, actually, it's one-state solution, because the other one is already recognized, I mean, Israel, by most of the countries, and especially in the Western world. So this is why I think it's one-state solution, and that one-state solution will bring to the recognition of Palestine as a state. And I can tell you, within the European Union, of course, Spain, we've been very vocal since the beginning, but there are more and more countries that are more and more sympathetic with this idea.
And in terms of recognition, there's another thing going on, which is if Palestine is going to be a state, it needs to be a UN member as well.
Absolutely.
And the Palestinian ambassador to the UN has sent a letter to the UN Secretary General. That's the first step. Mm. And then they go to the Security Council. I'm told around the Security Council table, among the 15 members, they have the 9 votes they need. The question is the Americans, because they have veto power and they could veto this. What is your message to the US on Palestine becoming a UN member and on recognitions? Should the US recognise Palestine as a state as well?
I think that the Biden administration is, you know, trying to do their best in order to find a political solution to this terrible war. So I recognise that political will. Second, what we saw first in the Ukrainian war and afterwards in Gaza is that more and more politically, the debate and the influence are not in the Security Council, but on the General Assembly. I do believe that in the General Assembly, there's a huge majority of countries that agree with this petition made by the Palestine Authority to get that full membership of the UN.
Around the General Assembly, though, and countries on the General Assembly, and I've had it on this programme with the President of Brazil, for example, yep. There's a claim there's double standards going on here. When you look at Ukraine and Gaza, if attacking hospitals and bombing civilians is wrong in Ukraine, then why was it not wrong in Gaza? Do you think the Gaza statements, the Gaza policies of some of your other Western allies are going to make it harder to get international support for the other war that's still going on? Perhaps we're not focusing on it so much in Ukraine.
From my perspective, what I see is that we have a current position, I mean in Spain, and we are with Ukraine because we defend a world order based on rules. And one of these main pillars, as you know quite well, is the respect of the international or national sovereignty and the territorial integrity of a country, which is nowadays not respected by the way, a full member of the UN Security Council, the Putin regime, no, Russia. And because we are current, we also are current and very vocal on the war in Gaza, because what we are witnessing tabled a lot of questions. One of them, if it's Israel respecting or not and fulfilling or not the UN Security Council resolutions or for instance, the international humanitarian law. So, again, I think that because we are current in Ukraine and in Gaza, we are defending, you know, the international law.
How worried are you about the situation in Ukraine? Because a year ago, there was all this talk of a counter-offensive. Since that, by the Ukrainians, since then and in recent months, very slowly, it seems the Russian side are the ones that are making gains. Gaza has all the attention. It means that potentially the funding, the weapons are going away from Ukraine. And then you have another specter on the horizon in November. You might get President Trump back in the White House, who might pull the plug from President Zelensky completely. Are you worried that Ukraine's going to lose this war?
I don't think that Ukraine is going to lose this war, because today everybody in the world knows that there is a nation called Ukraine that wants to be respected and defend their own freedom in order to be closer to the European Union and to our values. And, by the way, to be member of the European Union in the coming future. So I don't think that they're going to lose the war. And I don't think that Putin is going to win the war. Not at all, because in the beginning of the war, what he wanted to do is to invade 100% of the territory of Ukraine. And this is not the case anymore. So I think that the big risk is that we are witnessing a kind of frozen conflict.
Prime Minister, you skillfully dodged the last part of my question. President Putin, you say, is not going to win the war in Ukraine.
He's not going to win the war.
President Trump might well win the election in November. He says he can sort this out in a day. He could undercut President Zelensky. And as you know, there are all sorts of fears. I mean, he's doubting Article 5, the basic rule of the NATO Charter, the all-for-one rule. If one's attacked, you all support them. Are you worried about the possible return of President Trump?
Well, I'm a progressive prime minister. My government is a progressive one. So what I would like to have is, first of all, have great relations with President Biden and his administration. I would like to be him re-elected as president of the U.S., but this is something that has to be responded by the U.S. citizens. What we are looking for is to have the best relations with the U.S. administration, Trump, or Biden, or who is in charge of and leading the country. And I think one of the major bonds between the U.S. And Europe is NATO, is our transatlantic bond, our transatlantic relation. And I think this is above the prime minister or the president of one or other country. No, it's something that is strategic for the security, not only for Europe, but also for the US. So I don't think that we are going to witness a weakened position of NATO in the coming years in the case that Trump wins the elections. What we are going to witness is what we are seen over the past 2 years, which is a stronger NATO. And this is caused by Putin's war. This is the paradox. The paradox is that what Putin wants was not only to invade Ukraine, but also to weaken the NATO. And what he has accomplished is the contrary. Now you have Sweden, you have Finland, you have a stronger NATO, and then within the European Union, we have a stronger conscience that we need to do more on our defense and deterrence capacity. And this is something that we are already doing within the European Union. So I always say that we don't have a problem with the Russian society, but we have a problem with a regime which is putting into question the borders and therefore the security, not only of Ukraine, but also of Europe and therefore of the whole world. And this is something that we need again to solve through diplomatic ways. But unfortunately, today is not possible. Let's see and let's hope that in the future we can find that way.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much indeed.